March into spring with this unbeatable deal from Breezeline. Get reliable, fiber-powered 500 megabits internet for $39.99 per month, plus a $100 gift card and price lock guarantee. This deal gets even better with a free modem, free installation, and free Wi-Fi your way home. Safeguard your network from cyber threats and manage user access for all connected devices with this amazing offer. Act now. Terms and conditions apply. Offer expires May 6, 2024. Learn more at breezeline.com.
This is DeRay, and welcome to Bot Save the People. In this episode, it's me, Kaya, Diara, and Miles, talking about the underreported news from the past week. This week, we talk about sports, we talk about my Supreme Court case, we talk about politics. As usual, the place to come to hear what you probably didn't hear in the past week. Here we go. Book bans are on the rise, and it's on us to fight back. Luckily, the Crooked Store is doing a flash sale on all Free the Books merch. Free the Books tees, sweatshirts, and magnets are 30% off, but the sale won't last long, so make like a conservative who found out about a book with a gay character and jump on it. Head to crooked.com/store to shop before the sale ends.
Family, welcome to another episode of Pod Save the People. I am Diara Ballinger. You can find me on Instagram at Diara Ballinger.
I'm Malzie Johnson. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter and TikTok at Feral Rapture.
I'm Kaya Henderson on Twitter at Henderson Kaya.
And this is DeRay.
All right, we're going to kick off today really getting into this case, DeRay's case, which, I mean, DeRay, I feel like since I've known you, which has been years, this case has been sort of pending, going back and forth, Court of Appeals, Louisiana State Supreme Court, now at the Supreme Court. But the latest ruling, which I still have a hard time, like, I'm reading it, and I'm sure, DeRay, this is even worse for you since you're named in the in the case. I'm reading it, but I can't, it just does, it's not computing to me. It really is wild that you can be held liable for organizing a protest. Like, it's just, I don't understand. So can you sort of walk us through what is happening and also just sort of what you can tell us and sort of the lead up to this? And I've actually, I've heard it from friends of ours that were with you that day, but I've actually never heard it from you.
So in 2016, I went down to support the protests that were a response to the killing of Alton Sterling. In Baton Rouge, incredible organizers put it together. I went down to support. There were a group of us that went down to support. I flew after work on Friday, got to Baton Rouge, met with some people, went to sleep. Next day was the protest. I got arrested pretty early in going out. Like, the police told me to get out of the street. I got out of the street because I didn't want to get arrested, did not plan to get arrested anyway, spend the next 17 hours in jail. When I get out, there are five officers who have sued me. There were a couple, if you remember, at that time, some officers got shot in Dallas. Their family members sued me for saying I incited a riot. And then other officers in Baton Rouge. All five cases got dismissed, which was great, including this case. And then they appeal this case and we lose on appeal. And that's how this started. I've been to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals twice, lost both times. I've been to the Supreme Court now twice. They sent it to the Louisiana State Supreme Court the first time to ask if I could be sued under Louisiana state law. They were trying to punt it away from being a federal question. Louisiana said I could be sued. That was not what we wanted. So then I had to go back to the Supreme Court now that we had an answer to the question that they asked. And when went back to the Supreme Court decided not to hear the case. Luckily, Sotomayor did write a statement. And her statement essentially says that they already answered this question in another case after the Fifth Circuit wrote their decision, but before this week. And people should look at that decision. And because of that decision, they don't need to make a decision on this case. So that's where we are. You know, I do think some of the coverage has been more alarmist than true at this point, is that the other case that they named, the Counterman case, combined with Claiborne, which is the historic civil rights case that does not let people sue protest organizers for civil damages, those are strong. And, It will be really hard, given those two cases, for someone in the three states covered under the Fifth Circuit to be held liable for that bad decision that still exists in the Fifth Circuit, which is the decision about my case. So the ACLU will represent people if they are charged under that case or if there are cases brought under that case. And I now might have to go to a jury trial in Baton Rouge, which I am not excited about. So we are, for the first time, I did get deposed. I sat through a couple hours of a deposition. We deposed the officer, but all of the actual case about whether it happened or not has been on hold because we were dealing with the question of could I be sued at all. So here we are, and back to district court I go.
DeRay, do you think that, I mean, one, I thanks for clarifying that because the media coverage is very alarmist. Do you think this has a chilling effect on protest organizers? What do you think is the broader, like the technicalities of your case are one thing, but then there's the broader narrative and the broader effect on protests. What do you think that looks like at this point?
Yeah, you know, that was our whole legal claim, is that we were worried about the chilling effect that would happen. I will tell you, you know, I'm so lucky to have the ACLU represent me. We have a Supreme Court lawyer is also on our team. We have like a whole set of incredible, really talented people who are doing this as a part of the case because I knew them or have relationships that leverage them. And with all of that support, this is still a lot. Like, I have to turn over the text messages and all this. It's just a lot to do. And I do worry about how this could crush people even if they'll win in the end. Getting roped up in these court cases for this long is like a lot of work. It's a lot of time. It's money. It's travel. And that, I think, is actually the real danger here, because I could see people sort of accepting a consequence or just sort of settling because the weight of the system. And I've been in this case since 2016. It's 2024. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll keep everybody posted on how it goes and what's next. Maybe they'll drop the charges. Who knows? I don't know. But we are prepared for a jury trial in Baton Rouge at some date coming soon.
This country's something else, ain't it?
Yeah, I want to ask you all the questions I really have to ask you are really messy. So I'm trying to I'm trying to keep it cute. I don't have any unmessy questions to ask. I guess I'm curious about, I know, and I can only imagine like how your spirit's doing with actually doing this case, but also I'm curious about like how you're reacting to like other people's reactions to the case. Like people use like social media reactions, people using this as like a way to like be alarmist about even the case, but also to like perpetuate like narratives around you. Like, I think I'm just curious about all of this happened, like what's going on in your brain as all of these things are happening simultaneously, because it's not just the Supreme Court case, it's also a public opinion case now, and it's a social media thing and all these other things happening. So I wanted to know about that.
Yeah, I can't wait till the case is actually over so I can talk about some of the things that the lawyers are like, you can't say this now, that I know from the deposition, or I know, you know, so like that is, I can't wait for that day. I will say, I was surprised to wake up and see people being like, you know, he centered himself in this. I'm like, the police sued me. I didn't sue myself. I didn't ask the police to sue me. We have said it every step of the way, like that they brought these claims with no facts that I organized anything. I'm like, I did not organize a thing. And they sort of, what I can say is that the police's sort of claim is that my social media presence was a galvanizing force enough to be organizing. That is one of their major claims, sort of. And I don't know. What I'm fascinated by is the same people who are like, you know, they hate me and I do no work. Center me. So they center me more than I center me. I think I'm fascinated by that. I'm like, you know, if I wasn't a big deal, but you talk about me so much. And the people that I don't like, I literally act like they don't exist. I'm not spending a whole lot of time talking about them. So I was surprised to see sort of the narrative of, you know, he did this, like he lost the right to protest. I'm like, they sued me. I didn't sue these people.
And what do you think your relationship, I mean, I know that you can't just predict it, but what do you think your relationship with protesting and public organizing is now in the future? Has this dimmed it? Are you rethinking how you're like organizing things? Like, has it shaped what you even want to participate in?
No. So the ACLU has been really clear to me, and they've wanted me to tell everybody that the right to protest is still alive and that they will support anybody who is threatened with this ruling from the Fifth Circuit. So I feel as strong about protesting as I did before. I do need to get out of this case. So I'm like, you know, I'm trying to, you know, and there's some courts around the country that don't like, Louisiana's one of them, who don't like the public weighing in on things. So we have, you know, I haven't written essays about it, haven't tweeted about it, really the facts. Whereas there are other cases, courts like in New York, where they're so used to the media, or like, you know, you think about all those places where the, like California, where the courtroom trials are publicized. Louisiana is not a place that likes the public weighing in on things. So we have been pretty quiet and not fought this in the press. We fought it in the courtroom. I saw somebody who pretends to be a journalist do this whole thread about this case. And I'm like, did you read what we wrote? Like, you didn't read our brief. Mm-hmm. You didn't read the four amicus briefs that were in support of ours. You didn't read Sotomayor's statement. You just are like going on vibes. And that is actually the only thing that is annoying to me. What do you think, Miles? What do you think by seeing the conversation that has emerged?
I think that everybody, I understand the barrier to journalism and law more. I believe in it more and more every day, that you need to go to school somewhere or get some type of training or get some type of like if not institutional, experiential pedigree before you start doing stuff. Because what I do think is that I see people making this case about you, and it's and although you're named, it to me it becomes obvious that this is about something way bigger than you, and it makes me sad/aggravated that so many people are in their own way so fascinated with popularity, social media, celebrity, that they can't remove you. You know, it's what I've always been able to not like somebody, but also say, oh, this person is a Black trans queer person. I want them to be just as protected and just as and have just as much access as I do, because that's one for all, you know? And to me, it's aggravating when things like this become flattened into like the social media fodder. So whatever was fascinating you on Shade Room or went viral yesterday, now this is a part of it. And this is, you know, frankly, like more important and more substantial. So attacking this like you would a Shade Room post seems like just really irresponsible. And it makes me sad that even in moments like this, we can't just kind of like, okay, let's put our grown-up pants on and like, let's hate DeRay tomorrow. God willing, he'll still be here to hate tomorrow. But today, we can't let this happen, because this is obviously, this means a lot for everybody else who decides to protest and organize too. So those are my initial thoughts that I can say publicly. The other ones I have would involve a lot of curse words.
And I think, Miles, what you're talking about is just like the humanity of it, right? Like, DeRay, it's actually really hard for me to look at those pictures of you being arrested. Like, it's not... I think that's why the headline, it's all been as someone who is dear to me, it's been like a lot to see and to see with such frequency. And so I think everything that Miles said, I think that that's when you can't look, I mean, from my point of view, when you can't look at a Black body that's being taken off and have some empathy, y'all really are worshiping at the social media gods. I hope I'll never catch that bug.
Kaya, I'm interested in what you have to say about the Caitlin Clark, WNBA, the shoe deals. This was a big topic last week on Twitter, at least, that there are only three women who have signature shoe deals in the WNBA. They are all white. Caitlin Clark just got the third. And it sparked a conversation both about race in the WNBA. Sparked a conversation about Aja Wilson, who is a star in the WNBA and also does not have a signature shoe. And I was like, let's see. I want to see what the people got to say about this. But Kai is our resident sports expert. Please lead us.
Oh my gosh. That really is the funniest thing in America. But here is what I think. So I think we have to separate basketball and business, right? And there are two different things going on. It is absolutely right that Caitlin Clark has no NCAA. She don't have a ring. She has not even started to play in the WNBA yet. And that, you know, basketball, not even just women's basketball, but basketball is largely a Black sport, and the disparate treatment, everything from, you know, the headline after the national championship being about her losing instead of Dawn Staley in South Carolina winning, all of that, right? I'm here for it all as a Black woman. Let's put that aside for a minute. Caitlin Clark's marketing potential, business potential, the amount of money that she's generating in this sport is staggering. And you know, we run in a capitalist country. Like, literally, I learned today that the WNBA season kicks off in a couple of weeks, right? Already, her jersey has outsold any other rookie jersey in history. Already, the ticket prices for the Indiana Fever are triple what they were before they recruited her. And this was staggering to me. Other teams are changing the venue of where they play when they play Indiana because they're expecting record crowds. So, for example, the Washington Mystics play in a 4,000-seat arena. They are moving to a 20,000-seat arena because they expect that kind of a capacity crowd for Caitlin Clark. And so the shoe people are super smart because she will sell out zillions of shoes. And I don't think that you can ignore that. I mean, it don't have to be right. But what I am saying is you cannot ignore the marketing impact that this girl is having on sports, not just even women's sports. And so I don't think that, you know, is it just? No. But, you know, Aja Wilson, people are not moving their venues to come see her. And so that's why I think you're seeing I think you're going to see a record number. We were arguing about this morning, right? It's a whatever, 8-figure deal. It could be as low as 10 million. It could be as high as 90 million. We have no idea, but I think that Nike has an opportunity. It's my last point on this. Nike has an opportunity to position itself as a champion for women if they give her a really good deal. Because basically what they can say is, we think it's trash that she gets, that women get so little in the WNBA. We've been part of perpetuating that. We want to give this girl, you know, what we think she's really worth. And that could actually change the game in terms of what many women get in their deals. And she might be a flash in the pan. Who knows? But I think it is an interesting thing to watch. But I really do think from a business perspective, I'm not surprised at all about this.
I like that. I think so, too, because even, and I could like totally be wrong, but from my perspective, and I think this is true with like celebrity culture in general, it's such like a it's like hard to know what comes first. Like sometimes it feels like a company makes the star or makes somebody really important. Yep. So it doesn't always feel like that person, like in the hugest air quotes ever, earned it. And then they get it, even though that's the narrative people like to see. Sometimes it's just like, oh no, like we kind of decided that this is the person. And I'm not the sports person here, but I have heard about people, like companies, like almost like creating sports stars out of people who weren't the best players. And absolutely, I look back and be like, you think these are the best players, but that might be somebody who's in my consciousness as as one of the best players because they were so popular or because they got these big deals and because they kind of transcended popular culture or sports culture and went into popular culture. So I think that you're totally right, Kaya, around like, oh no, this also like these big stars and big deals are also like created, and why not take the chance on creating that with women, specifically in this moment. Yeah, and I think Nike only has things to gain from doing something like that too.
Yeah, I do think too. I'm the last 10 years I've been really interested in like our inability and hoping that there's more of an ability to name things as phenomenon, as opposed to trying to like, you know, scientize it and yes, systematize. It's like some things just. So when I think about like Caitlin, when I think about Angel Reese, I first knew her as the Bayou Barbie. That was, mm-hmm, you know, she was, I remember, I only knew Caitlin Clark because she waved off Raven. And that was like this meme moment and da 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 da. And that created like that whole last year created like that, I think, laid the foundation for this year to even be a thing where we could come back and look for the rivalry and the drama and the, we knew all the players because last year was such a crazy year in women's basketball and college women's basketball. And it was like, well, Caitlin broke all these records this year. And you're like, that just, it's just, it's true. Like that, it's true. And I do think about her as like a phenomenon in a certain way. And I like, you know, I don't try to like explain all of it. I also think that Angel also like it has incredible marketing potential and will do a lot for the sport in the way that she did last year. Like we all, the Bayou Barbie is like a whole thing. That's like that was a big deal. So I do see a disparity in the way that brands sort of respond to them. I also think there is something very different about their bases, like who are, you know, they are speaking to very different people. And that I think is fair to critique.
Yes.
The last thing I'll say is I do love that it doesn't seem like the negativity in the public has seeped into their relationships. And I love that. Mm-hmm. Like, I love that, like, this class of WNBA people are like, we not talking about each other online. Mm-hmm. We not fighting each other online. Our family's not fighting each other. Even when Diana Taurasi and Sue Bird are saying shady things, Caitlin is like, I can't wait to play. Angel is like, I can't wait to be a rookie again. You're like, mm-hmm, you won the national championship a year ago, made it. And her quote is, I can't wait to be a rookie again. And you're like, yes. You know, I also didn't realize how sexist the WNBA used to be. It used to make those women show up in business clothes at the draft. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy that they don't have to wear business clothes anymore because that was silly. And I'm happy they got to dress the way they wanted to dress.
Dre, I just want to pick up on that because as somebody who, I love the WNBA. And I love the New York Liberty and the Washington Mystics. And I go to these games and you actually feel
much more excitement than you do at them NBA games.
So much more exciting. They're so much more inclusive. And the vibe is very much like a unity, joyful vibe, mm-hmm, as opposed to like an adversarial, competitive vibe. And it these games are amazing. So I think what these women are also doing is sort of like revolutionizing the way we even approach sports and how sports are actually supposed to bring us together, not separate us. And I think that's exactly how you feel. And I think that's the sentiment now that even this class is taking in to the NBA. And I think it's absolutely incredible. And I can't wait to see them. And I have so many favorites that I follow on the Instagram, like Tasha Cloud, she's one of my favorites. Now she plays with for the Phoenix, whatever they're called. But I love them. Love it, love it, love it. And happy to see this and hope we just keep on covering the WNBA as Kaya is our resident expert as the months go on.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
Pod Save the People is brought to you by Factor. Warmer, sunnier days are calling. Fuel up for them with Factor's no prep, no mess meals. Meet your wellness goals in time for summer thanks to the menu of chef-crafted meals with options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are dietitian approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So no matter how busy you are, you'll always have time to enjoy nutritious, great tasting meals. With 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons to choose from each week, you'll always have new flavors to explore. You can crush your wellness goals this May with dietitian-approved meals and ingredients that you can trust. Make your day delicious from breakfast to dessert. Stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. Treat yourself to restaurant-quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp and blackened salmon. Now, let me tell y'all, they sent me the Factor meals and it is absolutely true. 2 minutes, pop it in a microwave, and it literally is restaurant quality food. So far, my favorites are chicken parmesan. I am a chicken parmesan connoisseur. This stuff is good. It has broccoli and tomatoes and it is creamy and amazing. Yum. So easy to throw it in the microwave and have a good meal. I'm saving money. I'm not eating out at restaurants so much. It's healthy. Like, I cannot say more about Factor Meals. So if you want to be down with this, head to factormeals.com/PSTP50 and use code PSTP50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month. That's code PSTP50 at factormeals.com/PSTP50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active.
Posse of the People is brought to you by BetterHelp. Now, whew, y'all, the beginning of this year has just been a lot going on, like from work and family and friends and just, you know, the weather's been awful in New York City and Baltimore. There are a lot of stressors happening, big and small. And when we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/people today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp. HELP.com/people.
So y'all, my news today is about Participant Media shutting down. And so for those of y'all that don't know, Participant Media is, it's essentially a production company, film, documentary, TV series from time to time. But it was founded really under the premise that you could use content to evolve people's thinking, being, and actually then compel them to act on a particular issue or societal challenge. And so I've worked with Participant on and off probably since like 2017. So the first thing I did with Participant was When They See Us with Ava DuVernay. And that's really, When They See Us is such an excellent example of Participant's work in the world, because it really was to build social impact campaigns that accompany these films. So for When They See Us, Dre, you probably remember that we did a big push around prosecutorial reform, because as we know, with the Exonerated Five, really what the challenges with them were an overzealous prosecutor who sort of went unaccountable and sort of her powers were so unbalanced in terms of what she did to prosecute those kids and all of the illegal things she did to prosecute those kids. But all that to say, you know, then, you know, Just Mercy, Judas and the Black Messiah, and then even things like Inconvenient Truth, that was a really early one for Participant. American Factory, you know, sort of the list goes on and on. Roma, in terms of the films that Participant really put investment into, both in terms of getting the thing made, but then also in terms of making sure that there were these really mega impact campaigns that really talked about the themes, the important themes in these films and how we can change a particular challenge, whether through policy, whether through community organizing, whether through just like building a network of folks who are coordinated in their efforts and their advocacy. So I'm really bummed that they're closing their doors. And just some really great people that I've worked with over the years. And they've been such an incredible vehicle for impact and for making the case why impact around film and documentary is so important. Now, you can't talk about Participant without talking about the Green Book. So that Participant did green Book. And I remember sitting in a conference room with the head of Participant, the head of marketing, all the white peoples. And I say, y'all, what are you going to do when Green Book wins the Oscar? And, you know, I'm fresh and new out of politics in sort of the film world. And they're like, oh, it's never going to win. Roma's going to win. Because Participant was also producer of Roma at the time. I say, y'all, I don't know the film business, but I know white people. And that film is going to win. And it did. And it did. And so it's been an interest. It's also been an interesting case study with Participant. And even with like Mahershala himself, for a film to win an Oscar, but then everyone to be really sort of apprehensive around talking about operating around the film, amplifying the film. So it's sort of like won the Oscar, but yeah, just an interesting journey with Participant. And I think Participant learned a lot about Green Book. And I think that's how you went from Green Book to Judas and the Black Messiah. Right. Cause it was like, oh, maybe we should get
those were not some black... right behind each other, were they?
They were in my tenure. They were
but
not
they
right,
were
behind,
not
each
right
other.
Behind each
no,
other.
No, okay. No, it was an effort. Just Mercy was in between.
Okay. All right. Let's not talk about people's least fine moment, right, Brian? Brian Stevenson says we're not our worst thing that we've ever done. So,
but I will say it sort of was an inflection point with them that I think had not happened, wouldn't have got them to where they are. But you know, dang, now it's closing. So, you know, I just think that film is so important to representation and shaping minds and shaping our culture. And it's so critically important to make sure that we have folks in the film business. And we've talked about this sort of ad nauseum before that are true to people and true to experiences. And so it's a bummer. It's a bummer that, you know, Participant, even with its flaws, is closing its doors. It also provided a lot of opportunities to, you know, new up and coming directors of color, talent. So just wanted to bring it here because I've been bummed about it this week. So just wanted to share that with y'all.
It's a little scary, right? Because how I see it, and please, you know, illuminate me if I'm wrong and direct me and drop some links. But how I see it, entertainment is getting a little dumber and getting a little bit more shallow. And I also think that this is reflecting maybe the exhaustion people have with, you know, like kind of like for the last like 5 to 10 years of people really having a lot of this like kind of like social, politically aware content and creativity coming out. And I think that it's really, I think sometimes we can take for granted like companies that champion ideas and social and political advancements and folding that into the entertainment and art that we are seeing. Because if Hollywood's left to their own devices, we get things that are, I'm not going to name anything, but we get things that are not necessarily interested in that and centered. So it is a little scary to not have somebody or have a company that's on the team of, okay, we need to get this out, or, oh, this is what this story is talking about. How do we make sure that this story and this social impact translates into the world? And how can we make it so this film doesn't just end at the credits, but we could actually make sure this like impact ripples throughout society and throughout culture. So it's a little scary. Also, because I remember reading the article about the Higher Ground, Barack Obama and Michelle Obama's President Obama's company that kind of have a very mm-hmm. similar angle and stuff. Mm-hmm. The thing is about that, and specifically about them, is that I don't know if they would have done Black Messiah. You understand what I'm saying? I don't know if they would have done certain things that don't necessarily interest their neoliberal new wave conservative ideals. So I do think that we can't just rest on oh, they got it, or these people have mm-hmm. it, because people with political interests who are making entertainment have those political interests still. So I liked, and I'm probably being a smidge more naive than I really am around this company, but it did seem like there was a bigger breadth of things that could be talked about and be seen. And I think that has to do with people maybe just wanting things to get more progressive. And there's something different that happens when people want things to get more progressive in their own way. So I do think there's still a huge emptiness left with this company not being here anymore. That is just not replaceable with like higher ground or something that has a former president and first lady behind it, because there's going to be obvious interest in that.
Miles, I think that's absolutely right. And I even think it goes to sort of like, just like how we put ourselves in these boxes just around genre, right? I think even for Black folks to do, whether it's Afrofuturism or even something like American fiction, right? I think it's like, I think for Hollywood, it's either like, for Black people, it's like, it's a slave movie, it's a bang bang shoot 'em up movie, and it's a love story. And those are sort of like our areas of operation. And so when you do, I think Participant had started to really build a muscle around, like right now, that I'm very curious about, Khalil Joseph has, who is a visual artist, has a film. It's like a doc narrative called Black News that Participant is producing. But even for them to take on something like that, that really was just like, you really weren't sure what it was, but you trusted in his genius that it was going to be something that sort of fell outside the normal bounds of like what a film genre was. Yeah, so I think it's even spaces and places that just really push Black creativity. We just need more of that.
I will say what this reminded me of is that I think the highest decision makers in Hollywood have not changed. That I think a lot of people changed. I think there are a lot of layers that changed. I think that creators got more access than they ever got. But, you know, I don't buy I do think people are I think there is fatigue, but I think people are more fatigued by living in poverty and in a crazy world than they are in talking about it. And I think I find people every day who are like trying to make sense of what's happening, who are looking for content that helps them make sense of what's happening. So it doesn't feel so overwhelming and doomsday. They're trying to understand how we got here and what it means. And you know, I think there are interesting people making that content. I think that the decision makers are like, we are done talking about this. They are the people who are like, we are done platforming this. Da, da, da. And this is what that reminds me of. Because I think that people are hungry for the content still.
But are the films doing well? Just commercially?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, what film is doing well that's not a remake of X-Men, you know, or Superman? So if that is the bar, then I think they're doing as well as the other ones. Like, I don't think, you know, the blockbusters, there's a critique that even, like, do we need to remake Good Times in the way we did? You know, I think we're like remaking everything, you know?
But I think we're not even we're not seeing what could get made, I think is the issue, is that I think, and that's what, the director of American Fiction, I'm forgetting his name. What's his name?
Cord Jefferson.
Like, that's what he said in his speech. It's like no one, like he heard so many no's. So I think we don't even know the expansiveness of like what the film, what it could look like, because people are so busy making the remake of Good Times and the, you know. And so I think I also feel like right now, Ryan Coogler is making a thriller with Warner Brothers and getting, I would hope after Black Panther movies that he would get what he needs to be able to make, these will be blockbusters. But again, it's like Ryan Coogler is someone who has completely rewired how people interact with him in the film business. And the other thing I learned about this film Ryan Coogler's doing is that he arranged it so that he will actually own this film after a certain amount of years, which is the first time anybody's done anything like that, right? So I think it's like, we just need to see more and we need to figure out how to get more into the world. And I think, Miles, you talk about this a lot in terms of, we just got to get outside of these white institutions and sometimes Black institutions to do that. So
yeah. I guess just like to like DeRay's point, I guess I was just like thinking through, you see it, so many people trying to hit that that note. I think that like maybe like Jordan Peele, somebody who I can think of off the top of my head, who hit that note of like, okay, how do we create something that is Black, expansive, different narratives and stuff like that, and then also make money? Which to me, you know, is not necessarily the job of the artist all the time. You know what I mean? And I think that, like, I think I love Khalil Joseph. Like I think he's an absolute genius. I love Arthur Jaffa. I love these, like, people who I'm like, I don't want Arthur Jaffa thinking about the bottom line and budgets and stuff like that. Yeah. But it does seem like we're in an era for entertainment where people just... I remember reading about the Barbie movie and how Mattel actually invited different directors, Lena Dunham being one of them. Miss Greta, who did Barbie, to be one
Greta
of them.
Greta Gerwig. Miss Greta, I love it.
Right, but invited them to Mattel and basically said, like, hey, we have all these, like, you know, brands and, you know, toys and stuff like that with Mattel. Are you interested in basically making a movie around that? And I just think that, like, although you can get some cute, subversive pop feminist stuff, I also think that, like, wow, if that's where entertainment is going, that's kind of scary too. So I guess I guess just in my head, I'm just thinking out loud around how do we, is there a formula, or how do we make a formula of like what can be really impactful and expansive narratively, but also like gets people to watch and spend their money to watch and consume it, you know? Because it seems like that has not been a note hit.
I have a personal thought, and then I have a professional thought. And the personal thought is that participant media has had an outsized impact on me personally in two particular ways. So one, they did Waiting for Superman, which was the first film in recent history, documentary on education. And as somebody who's been in education for 30 plus years, it was really the first time that I saw my issues, a quick cameo of Me Too, but we won't even talk about that. but the first time that I saw my work lifted up on a movie screen, and that had a tremendous impact on me and changed the conversation about what was going on. And then as a small business owner, you know, my company does curriculum that is focused on African-American history and culture, and we partnered with Participant on a couple of their films. We did curricula for and a whole weekend of activities around Judas and the Black Messiah. We partnered with them on the Africatown documentary.
The Descendants.
Oh, yep.
Oh, everybody, please go watch The Descendant.
And and we also partnered with them on When They See Us. And so major movie studios don't reach out to small curriculum producers to partner on projects, and that was huge for us and gave us exposure and opened us up. And so personally, I'm really sad that we don't have that channel anymore. And then professionally, I am sad because I do think that they tried to put a stake in the ground around the fact that you could do good and do well at the same time, that you could make socially conscious movies and make a good bottom line, and that this was the right thing to do. And I hope that message isn't lost, or I don't want that to be defeated. Mm-hmm. I want that to still be an idea that people embrace. We literally were not talking about climate change until An Inconvenient Truth, period, the end. Like, there is nobody who can debate the importance of that film in bringing climate change to the forefront. And so I worry about those discussions nowadays. I think it also, I think it also points to the changing role of of studios, right? When any document, I mean, I have a ton of friends who are making important, impactful documentary films, and their goal was never to get to participant media. Their goal was to always go straight to Netflix and get a streaming deal. And so I think it also is indicative of the changing role of who makes movies and who decides which movies get made. And I'm deeply worried about films with social conscience topics and where they go in all of this. DeRay, I agree with you. I think people need these films and are hungry for the content that helps them make sense of our increasingly complex world. And so this is really a sad thing for me.
So my news is about Nestle. It came out that Nestle is adding sugar to products in the global south. So in the poorest countries, Nestle is adding sugar to infant milk and cereal or Cerelac, so like baby formula, intended for infants age one and above and for children between 6 months and 2 years. And in the European markets, like the UK, there is no sugar in the formulas for the same children. And the US guidelines and UK guidelines make it clear that children under 4 or under 2 should avoid sugar. So in the UK, it's under 4 and the US is under 2. And there are two major reasons. One is for obesity and weight gain, making sure that kids don't become obese as infants. But the second is also for tooth decay. So making sure that as their teeth come in, that they don't rot out because they have all this sugar. And it came out because a nonprofit had worked with people to do a study, and they saw that Nestle is putting sugar in foods. And it just made me think through, like, I'm like, you know, it's just a treacherous, capitalism is really something. And not only for the health issues, but you also, you know, these kids get addicted to sugar as infants. That's, you know, I think about how much Kool-Aid and all that stuff I drank as a kid and had to wean myself. I was like, you know what? I do not need sweet tea every single day. I'm like, I drank so much Kool-Aid and sugar. I drank a ton. I ate a lot of sugar when I was a kid. And now I have a much better relationship to those things. But I wanted to bring it here because I was shocked by this. And it was also frustrating to see that in white countries, the guidelines are followed by Nestle, and those same guidelines are ignored in the poorest countries and in the global south.
I'm sorry. So first of all, reprehensible. Second of all, not the first case. In fact, if I remember correctly, some time ago, we covered the fact that Johnson & Johnson was continuing to market their baby powder, the cancer-causing baby powder in it, or it hadn't changed the formula. Yeah, somebody look it up because I can't remember the details. But basically, you know, Johnson & Johnson was sued here in the United States for baby powder causing cancer in women, for all of the Black women at least who have, you know, used baby powder to stay dry and deodorize and all of that kind of stuff, and were hit with ovarian cancer and all kinds of feminine cancers. And I think, if I remember correctly, they forced to change the formula, but they did not change the formula in Central and South America and in Sub-Saharan Africa and places like that. And so I think this is... I think this is not unique, unfortunately. And I think that it goes to what the world thinks about people of color and poor people and capitalism and, yikes, horrible.
It just illustrates such a broad need for somebody, for people, for organizations that care about everybody, you know? I think that one of the things that, like, a friend was talking to me earlier this week about was thinking without borders in your head. And they were connecting this to gender, but also connecting this to, like, kind of like internalized imperialism and nationalism, and how it's really an important work to think globally. So it matters what happens to the children in America, and it matters what happens to children in UK, and it matters what what happened to the children in the Global South, and there shouldn't be different standards for those things. And I think Nestle is an example, but it really just illustrates how disappeared and not considered other children are in on the globe simply because of where they were born. And I would just want more organizations and more people to care globally about children, and just because of where they land on a border doesn't make what's happening to them any less important.
You know, y'all, I can't help myself, so I had to look up this global board of directors. I just put it in the chat. Mm-hmm. And what's fascinating is that they actually are like really boastful of their diverse and balanced board. We have a diverse and balanced board with complementary backgrounds providing a broad range of relevant skills and experience. And then they had a chart where they list everybody, they list their nationalities, but then they list the different skill sets that are important to them. And they're all very businessy, right? So like people who are CFOs and CEOs, international business, retail brand marketing, technology. What they don't have here is anybody who has an expertise in public health, which I don't understand why they don't, considering how they are putting foods that are detrimental to people out into the world. Like, I don't understand, just from like a building a board and company perspective, how you wouldn't have anyone that understands the human body on this board. But I guess it makes sense since they gotta put sugar in things, depending on the part of the world. But just an interesting thing. And you know, I love to look at sort of the board makeup, because that always tells you everything you need to know about that particular company. But,
yeesh. Okay, I want to circle back on a Johnson & Johnson story and get it right. So in 2020, it's talc in the Johnson & Johnson powder that it seems mm-hmm. causes ovarian cancer. And in 2020, which is when I started on this podcast, can y'all believe it's been 4 years? Whoop, whoop. But in 2020, Johnson & Johnson decided to end its talc-based sales in Canada and the United States, which is probably when we reported on this, because it was a travesty to only end sales in Canada and the United States and not end sales globally. But I'm happy to report, my friends, that Johnson & Johnson has decided to stop selling talc-based baby powder globally in 2023. So, as of this past year, it seems they are only selling cornstarch-based baby powder and no longer shortchanging the women of, or the people of color and poor people around the rest of the world that don't live in U.S. and Canada, and selling them talc-based stuff. So congrats, Johnson & Johnson, for being late to the party, but for figuring it out.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
My news this week picks up on Miles's article a couple weeks ago about Freaknik, which, if you remember, Freaknik started out as a Black spring break tradition in Atlanta for kids who couldn't go home over spring break. And I had never heard of Orange Crush or Tybee Island until this week, but it turns out that Orange Crush is the annual Black spring break bash on Tybee Island, which is Georgia's largest public beach. It's a small island, only 3 miles just east of Savannah. And Orange Crush started more than 30 years ago by students at Savannah State University, which is an HBCU. It was organized in 1988. And in fact, the current mayor of Savannah was one of the original organizers, and it was a university-sponsored event until 1991, when the university ended its involvement. And so the event since then has been unpermitted. Well, here's the problem. Tybee Island, again, 3 miles big, long, wide, whatever, 3 miles, has 3,100 residents. And last year, Orange Crush brought over 100,000 people to the party, which overwhelmed the small island. Their police force, which consists of 12 people, scrambled to respond to emergency calls reporting gunfire and drug overdoses and traffic jams and fistfights. Last year, there were 26 arrests, including one road rage shooting, where a white man fired a gun into another car and injured one person. This year, they are taking precautions to manage this differently by adding 100 additional sheriff deputies, Georgia State Troopers, and other officers that will be deployed to Three Mile Tybee Island. This does not sound like a recipe for success to me. The governor has also recently signed a bill, DeRay, that allows local governments to recoup additional expense costs from social media organizers of unpermitted events. And so, of course, there are racial dynamics, Tiara. Like you, I had to Google the stats and see what was going on. 92% of the island's residents are white. The mayor is white, and he has stated that his goal is to end this event. There is a very small Black population, one of which is the city manager, and she is responsible for operations. So what is she doing? She is focusing on managing the traffic. She's providing porta potties. She's setting up barricades to keep residential property safe. She is trying to manage the situation. The mayor said he's trying to end the event. There is a small Black population who remind us that Tybee Island has huge crowds for the 4th of July and lots of other summer weekends, but those weekends are largely white and the response is completely different. They are not calling out 100 additional police people. They believe that it will be over-policed and that all of this is because they believe that Black folks are criminals. And so what it made me wonder to myself is, you know, Daytona Beach welcomes hundreds of thousands of white kids. And you're not going to tell me that they're not drunk and crazy and, you know, doing all of the things that Black spring breakers do. But we don't read about that. We read about Miami, which shut itself down to Black spring breakers this past year. And so why is it not? Why is it? I already know why it is. But if we can tolerate white college students going to blow off steam and enjoy their spring break, where are Black college students supposed to go to enjoy their spring break together? It looks like it increasingly may no longer be Tybee Island. Apparently, Biloxi, Mississippi is billing itself as the annual Black spring break destination, and good for them if they can, you know, invite Black folks and cash in on all of the money that we bring to these places, because our money is green and it's long. But I really do, you know, I brought it here because we think about the criminalization of Black people. We think about the over-adultification of Black young people. We think about all of these things when, you know, all of us were young spring breakers many of us were young spring breakers at some point. Most of us.
Some of us are still.
But some of us are still. Oh, come on, nephew. who want to go places and have a good time with our friends. The vast majority of us behaving and doing what we're supposed to do. But this criminalization piece is, is par for the course. So I brought it to the pod because I had never heard of Tybee Island or Orange Crush. I also hope there's a couple of organizers who are 9 times out of 10 likely to be sued. And so thank you, DeRay, for sharing that the ACLU is willing to, I guess, protect against protests. Maybe not this, but it does, it will create an interesting, I think, legal standard once you start to sue these social media influencers, because You have to be able to, I think you have to be able to prove that they actually organized this.
Or that they had intent, that there was like intent behind other people's actions. Yeah. And like, no matter what I said about coming into the street, I certainly didn't tell people to hit the police upside the head.
Right. Well, thank you for bringing this to the podcast, Kaya, because this is a really interesting story, because ever since I brought the Freaknik thing into the podcast, I've been thinking about Daytona Beach in Atlanta, and now I'm thinking about Tybee Island. And I think the thing that, I don't know, this might be like a little like cynical, but I think what makes Daytona Beach work is because a lot of the police officers, the adults there, the older people there, see these kids who come as extensions of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some type of, so they say like, look at those crazy kids, but they see their nephew, they see their cousin, they see their children in them. So there's a type of like, even if it's annoyance, there's a type of like tolerance and grace that they have. Whereas Black children, you know, Tamir Rice, Trayvon Martin, are seen as just criminal, mm-hmm. and there's this projection of like see them as animals, mm-hmm. okay, when they're going around. So I think that obviously over policing it is going to birth more violence, but also I think that in order for there ever to be like a space for Black folks, or specifically for young Black folks, to be able to successfully celebrate and have fun, and maybe even make mistakes, but not have those mistakes decide the rest of their lives. You yes. have to be able to see those children, see those kids as kids. And I just don't think that is true for people. I don't think that's, for lack of better words, I don't think that's like interracially true. You know, I think that I see Black kids, 18, 19-year-olds and younger, and I see, like, oh, that's my cousin. Even if they're bad, I'm like, oh, there go my cousin, there go my, like, whatever. Or don't talk like that, or get out the street. But if you don't have that interracially, then you're just going to end up over-policing and then perpetuating violence on children because you see them as something to be scared of.
A couple things to add. One, this is stolen land, white people. Okay, so what are y'all talking about? Okay, so second of all, we all coming now. I just saw that the University of Georgia, Georgia Southern University, I believe, put together a project of Tybee, Martin Luther King, and actually the woman that was named in this article, Kaya, that's a uh-huh. resident there. Uh-huh. They have a whole Black history trail that takes you through Black contributions, Black history on this island. So not only are we going to have Orange Crush, we're going to have more programming activities to come. Okay. So y'all better start getting more police.
Let's go to Tybee Island.
Orange Crush, because, Mango Wisdom.
Yeah, yeah. Because it just, everything Pineapple don't belong Express. To y'all. Yeah. It does not belong to y'all. This is crazy. This is so wild. That's all I have to add.
You know, I'm from the suburbs of, born in Long Island, but grew up in the suburbs of Georgia. And if I remember correctly, Tybee Island is like in Savannah or right next to Savannah, like very close to that.
Yes, so, very close to
it. Yes. So, because I remember like just like hearing about it a lot. I don't think I ever visited there I can't remember, but I used to always go to Savannah. But it's also wild, speaking of this land stuff, like that's where a lot of Black people came in from.
Second largest slave port, I think, after Charleston.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, you know, to what you're saying about the indigenous land, it doesn't belong to you. But also, like, how dare you stop anybody from coming to the very place that y'all grabbed us from? Like, what? And sent us to? Like, that's a little ridiculous.
And now I'm on Zillow looking for homes. So here I come.
You about to be a resident. I love it. DR. Let's own us some land.
all the black people going to be there visiting their cousin DR. They're like, no, we ain't visiting DR.
Right.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Bossy of the People this week. Don't forget to follow us at Cricket Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Bossy of the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we'll see you next week. Bossy of the People is a production of Cricket Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Vasilis Futopoulos. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.
March into spring with this unbeatable deal from Breezeline. Get reliable, fiber-powered 1-gig internet for $59.99 per month, plus a $150 gift card and price lock guarantee. This deal gets even better with a free modem, free installation, and free Wi-Fi your way home. Safeguard your network from cyber threats and manage user access for all connected devices with this amazing offer. Act now. Terms and conditions apply. Offer expires May 6, 2024. Learn more at breezeline.com.